126, Section 2, Economic Development in Royal Georgia. As you read, look for the economy of early Georgia, methods of gaining land in Georgia, terms, naval stores, cash crop, headright system, Tudor. The royal period was a time of growth and increasing prosperity for the colony, especially in the right years. Georgia's economic base remained agriculture, and the farmers introduced new crops to the colony. Some of those crops required a great deal of work to grow, leading to the growing use of slave labor. The land policy changed, making it easier for settlers to get land and allowing them to have much larger land holdings. By the end of the period, Georgia's economy was becoming similar to the economy of its South Carolina neighbor. Georgia's early economy. All Georgian farmers, large or small, grew food crops, mainly corn, beans, peas, potatoes, and garden vegetables. These were subsistence crops, meaning they fed farmers and their families. Corn, which they learned to cultivate from the Indians, became the major food of most diets. It could be ground into flour for bread. If a farmer had a surplus of a crop, more than needed, the farmer would try to sell it, usually in the nearby town or community. Vegetables that would spoil quickly could not be taken very far, so they had to be sold nearby. The farmers also raised chickens, cows, and pigs. The low-lying coastal areas were good for growing rice because that crop requires fields that can be flooded with water at certain periods. Cultivating rice also takes many workers, so family farms did not produce rice. Large rice plantations emerged, some established by South Carolinians who moved to Georgia themselves or who got land and hired managers to oversee the work. By the 1750s, Georgia planters were also growing the indigo plant, from which they produced the blue dye that buyers in England wanted. Its cultivation had begun in South Carolina with the work of a young plantation mistress named Eliza Lucas, but it also grew well in Georgia. Georgia's production of the dye peaked in 1775 when 22,000 pounds were shipped to the mother country. Georgians continued to make money from their native pine trees. The trees were valuable not only for their timber, but also for their gooey sap from which tar, pitch, and turpentine were manufactured for use by the Royal Navy. Tar and pitch plugged gaps in the wooden ships, and turpentine was used for cleaning. These products were known as naval stores. In the backcountry, the fur and skin trade with the Indians continued, with Augusta as its center. In 1755, almost 50,000 pounds of deerskins went down the Savannah River for shipment to Great Britain. By 1765, that amount had risen to almost 20,000 pounds of skins. By 1770, it was almost 285,000 pounds. In 1770, almost 1,500 pounds of beaver furs were exported from Georgia. Over time, problems emerged in the new lands of the backcountry because the new farmers settling in the area resented Indians on their way to Augusta along the well-established trading paths. The farmers had begun to grow tobacco, which was the main cash crop, a crop grown to be sold for income of Virginia and North Carolina. They did not want Native Americans near their fields. Land policy. The key to doing well in Georgia was getting land. The restrictions of the trustee period were gone. In the royal period, settlers could acquire land in three ways. 1. They could buy it. 2. They could receive it as a gift or an inheritance. And 3. They could receive it as a grant, gift, from the colonial government. Every Tuesday, the governor and his council met and made grants of land. The size of a grant was based on the size of the applicant's household, which included not only family members, but also indentured servants and slaves. A head of a household could ask for 100 acres for himself or herself, and 50 additional acres for each member of the household. This method of granting land was called the headright system. While most land grants went to males, many went to women, mainly those who had never married, called spinsters, or those whose husbands had died, called widows. By the end of the royal period, women had received more than 70,000 acres in grants. If a woman got married, however, all of her property automatically became her husband's under the laws of that time. In the early years of the royal period, most settlers were attracted to the low-lying lands between the Savannah and Altamaha rivers. In 1763, the British government extended Georgia's territory to include the land between the Altamaha and St. Mary's rivers. Until then, that land had been part of South Carolina, although no one had settled there yet. After 1763, planters wanted the rice lands in this new area of Georgia. By this time, land in South Carolina was increasingly expensive and hard to get. Many Carolinians came to Georgia, bringing with them their slaves and the knowledge of rice and indigo production. The growth of towns. Most Georgians were farmers or planters, but Georgia's towns and villages supported other occupations. In Augusta, several important Indian traders formed a company called Brown, Ray, and Company. They were known as the Gentlemen of Augusta. Savannah had many successful merchant firms. Professionals also worked in towns. Doctors practiced medicine and pharmacy, although some early treatments like bleeding could result in weakening the patient. Savannah also had many government officials. Lawyers, who had not been allowed to practice in the colony during the trustee period, came to Georgia during the royal period. They were respected and valuable members of the colony. Many of these prominent townspeople also owned plantations in the countryside. Communities had artisans such as coopers, who made buckets and barrels. Cartwrights made carts and buggies. Blacksmiths made tools, nails, horseshoes, and other items from iron. Carpenters built with wood. Tanners made leather items from animal skins. Bakers made mainly bread. Tailors sewed men's clothing. Chandlers made candles. There were many other occupations. In the ports of Savannah and Sunbury were men who built and repaired boats and ships. James Johnston made his living as the printer of the Georgia colony, founding the first newspaper, the Georgia Gazette, in 1763. A few men were tutors, who made money by teaching children for a fee. Some men, and a few women, made their income by operating taverns and inns, the colonial equivalent of restaurants and hotels. These were gathering places where people talked about the events of the town. Taverns were important meeting places in the period of the American Revolution. Reviewing the section. 1. Define naval stores, cash crop. 2. Name the three ways settlers could acquire land in colonial Georgia. 3. How was the economy of royal Georgia different from that of trustee Georgia? Page 229, Doing Business in Georgia. Harris and Habersham. In 1738, James Habersham came to Georgia as a follower of George Whitefield and his Methodist ideas. In spite of a business background in London, he planned to serve as a missionary and schoolteacher. He helped Whitefield establish Bethesda Orphanage and School. When Whitefield returned to England in 1741 to raise money, Habersham took charge of Bethesda. The difficulty of supporting the orphanage and school led Habersham to return to business. With some of his profits, he became a supporter of the orphanage. In the mid-1740s, Habersham teamed with Francis Harris in a business. Harris had come to Georgia in 1733 and had worked in the store provided by the trust. When that closed down in 1742, Harris had opened his own store. Harris needed goods from Charleston to sell in his store. James Habersham was using a schooner, a small boat, to get provisions for the orphanage. In 1744, the two men formed the partnership of Harris and Habersham to sell goods to the colonists. Habersham made the early trips to Charleston for goods and kept the accounts, while Harris ran the store. The partners soon decided that they wanted to trade directly with London. In that way, their customers could buy British goods cheaper because they would not have to pay the Charleston middleman merchants. They were the first Savannah firm in the transatlantic trade. They established business contacts in London and built a dock in Savannah that was large enough for ocean-going vessels. Harris and Habersham, and later other firms, traded directly with merchants in Great Britain, shipping out rice and other raw materials and importing British-made goods for sale to the colonists. They also traded directly with the West Indies. From 1742 to 1752, the paper bills issued by Harris and Habersham were used for money, just as we use dollar bills. In the mid-1750s, Habersham and Harris became rice planters outside Savannah. They became the silent partners with Thomas Raspberry and Company, who ran the stores. After Raspberry died, Habersham returned to live in Savannah in the early 1760s. He helped others, including his nephew Joseph Clay and his sons James Jr. and Joseph, become merchants. As a leading planter and merchant, Habersham held important positions in the colonial government. During the late trustee period, he and Harris served on the Board of Assistants to the President. Habersham was a member of the Governor's Council beginning in October 1754 and acting governor while Wright was away in the early 1770s. He was a good friend to Henry Ellis and James Wright. His old friend and business partner, Francis Harris, died in 1771. Habersham died in 1775. They had been important men in the growth of Savannah's economy.